So, Drew, contrasting back to your military career and putting those traits, those key capabilities into context, when you were serving in the military, do you think those leadership capabilities were essentially the same or different?
I think they're essentially the same. I genuinely believe that, but I must, particularly with stakeholder engagement, I think it's different. It comes from perspective, if you understand what I mean, that in the military, you really need, a military leader needs to really be cognizant of their stakeholders, because the majority of their stakeholders probably aren't military. So their stakeholders don't share the same values and purpose as the military member does. They might be civilian staff, they might be civilian contractors, they might be local politicians or the local population. And you have to manage civilians differently to how, as the military, you operate. But as a civilian leader, if you've got a military person on your team, you're probably not likely to change your leadership style or your approach just because they're in your team. You'll just lead like a civilian. So I think that's the key difference, if any, that a military person needs to be aware that their style of leadership and how their people are already motivated or have a sense of purpose, that the rest of their stakeholders may not share that value.
I have a question, Drew, if I can, Ben. Sorry to interrupt, but I didn't want to lose this particular observation and question. So I'll start with the observation first. I am very much happy to hear that someone will refuse work or in contracts because their people are being treated like crap. That's something I would do, and I wouldn't be apologetic about it. I'd be in their face going, this is not, I don't need this to succeed. And that breeds a level of trust in people. If you didn't have their trust and they knew that you have their back, it makes your position a lot more easier in terms of leadership and making sure that those that are with you understand what motivates you. Because if at the end of the day, like you said, people are in jobs for different reasons and maybe wanting a paycheck, but it doesn't mean you treat them like crap, and it doesn't mean they're an expendable asset or a human resource. I hate that term, but you know, they're there, they're people, and they help you to be successful. So that's the observation. The question then comes, the first time, if you can cast your mind back, and please, I don't want to know the company involved, but the first time you made that call to say my people matter more than this contract, blow it out the you know what. When your thought process was there, were you thinking, did you have the devil and the angel on your shoulder going, hang on, maybe this isn't the right thing to do, maybe you need to rethink before you open your mouth, or did it just instinctively came, or did you think about how you were going to take that step? Because I would have been not hesitant, but at least you'd be thinking about it, because once you what's the terminology, and this is my geek history stuff, once you cross the Rubicon, that's it, there's no going back. Did that play on your mind before that first time that you said, stuff, yeah, not wearing this?
Yes, it did. Reputational damage or reputational risk is a key part of my thinking anyway. As you may recognise, my family name is my brand. It's my guarantee of quality. I have no stepping back from that. The whole Horsell generation and future generations relies on me, balancing that. But the reputational risk for me was probably not as significant as having my people being either hurt or mistreated or not treated to the standard that I would expect. And I'd love to think that, and again, it's quite a while back when the company wasn't as well off as we are now. And it wasn't a difficult decision, but it was certainly thinking, well, gee, if I don't take this work and walk away from this work, I'm going to have to get a line of credit. And now that the company's quite, you know, we're quite happy where we are, I don't think the decision would change. But at the time, it was probably a very brief moment of thinking, well, what would happen here? What would reputation risk be? But I think clearly outstanding that the angel on the shoulder was beating the devil over the head. So it wasn't a concern.
Cool. Thanks for that, mate.
Now, I'm going to get a bit nostalgic, Drew, and cast our minds back to April 1996. And you and I happened to be, I'm not sure if you remember this, but I certainly do, because it's probably one of my darkest moments that I've regretted for many, many years. Now, this is going rogue, Eric, so bear with me. Drew and I happened to be in the same section on what was then called Exercise Timor at Duntroon. Nowadays, Drew, I believe it's called Exercise Shaggy Ridge.
That's correct.
It is literally the hardest thing I've ever done. And I was privileged to do that 10 days out in the field with Drew in the same section. And to cut a very long story short, it's a leadership exercise where you do not eat or sleep for 10 days. Now, I was very, very fortunate in the fact that my assessment was on the night of day one. Drew's assessment was on the day of day nine. And Drew, I remember your, leadership in that situation, and I thought was exceptional. But you had a complaining, bitchy number 51 rifleman with red hair. And for 24 years, I've regretted how I performed under your command. So I'm here today to say I'm sorry. There you go. It took me 25 years to actually apologize, but I remember thinking to you, poor bastard, having to deal with hungry, tired cadets who were all chiefs in their own regard and then still be assessed at the same level of performance that I had on day one when we were relatively calm and relatively well nourished, but we were awful on day nine. And you somehow pulled it out. I remember you did a section attack and I was sitting there going, I don't want this shit. So, Drew, I'm very, very sorry for how I performed that day.
but no, and Ben, to be honest with you, I remember it quite well. It's one of those things in my life that I too, it's one of the toughest things I've done. But I'd also like to think that by that end of that time is that the directing staff would have recognised that we're all fatigued, we're all hungry, we all wanted to be elsewhere. But I think the key part of military college life or even that military team environment was that everybody knew that if the leader failed, the team failed. And I think even as you apologise, and you don't need to, of course, none of us do, but I think every one of us back then, and in every team I've been in since, if the leader fails, the team fails. Mm. And if you're part of a key team and you recognise your value in a team, no one wants to fail.
Absolutely.
Please let me ask a question here. What is the inherent value of an exercise that starves the participants by not giving them food and water for a period of time? Please explain to me the benefit for your leadership and or those coming out from under you, because I understand you've got to do extreme things because you guys have to respond in extreme situations. But please explain to me the logic of it. I don't understand it. Why would you put yourselves through that unless that? So as ignorant as I am to the process, the only thing that stands out is a denial of food and water is to put you in two minds, so to speak, your body fatigued and wanting food and nourishment versus how do you overcome that? Was that the purpose, or is there some higher purpose to a 10-day let's get slim, no food, no water exercise? I'd love to be able to do that myself, but I think at day three I'd be smashing the walls and or failing quite miserably. So tell me, Drew, please explain, and for those that are listening, why? What was the purpose?
No, I think it's largely the former that you mentioned about. It is breaking down that physical and mental response. So if you can imagine in a normal environment, you have a trained response. So you asking me these questions today, I can go, well, that's a good question. Thank you, Eric. Let me answer by saying, and I can rehearse, I can train and I can prepare. But on day nine, as Ben says, that's out the window. I'm tired. I'm filthy, dirty. I'm pissed. If you ask me a question, I will tell you the truth, whether you like it or not. I was fortunate. I did a couple of courses like this in my career, and I went on to do, I did the commando selection course in 1998 and failed. I made it through the course physically, but wasn't accepted because of the mental duress. I was arguing with the directing staff on day five or day six. We had to go up and down these hills, and every time we'd get to the top of the hill, the staff would say, you're 15 minutes late, go over to the next hill. And after the fourth time of doing that, I'm arguing with this guy saying, no, we're on time. We're on time. And I had completely lost the plot. I was so physically and mentally fatigued that they saw that my real character, I couldn't see anymore that this was just a test. I was literally so far into the real environment that I thought it was realistic. And
so what would have been the proper response in that scenario when you said, hey, I'm on time, and they're saying, no, go again, you're 15 minutes. What would have been what response were they looking for?
You turn around, you say, righto team, we weren't fast enough. Let's put our gear on. Let's move to that next hill and let's get it right this time.
See. Okay. Instead, you became the Eric Perez belligerent, asking questions, demanding to.
Correct.
I'll be honest. I would have been saying the same exact shit or probably verbalizing it in a lot different way, going, mate, stop stuffing around with my time. And that, I guess, that answers one of the questions I've always had in my mind is for those that go to that elite level of training where they destroy you physically, and I mean that in every sense of the word, they're trying to push you to your limits. Even through all that, the best leadership is those that can put that aside and still maintain a clear road ahead. Now, is that Is that why it's made so hard to get into those special branches, because they want people that are at that level and cannot accept anything below that?
I think it's the ability to operate in extreme environments with extreme circumstances and to have clear decision-making skills. Like I say, I talk about whether it be exercise team or Shaggy Ridge or special forces training, was that I didn't have that mental capacity to say, hang on a second, if I think about this clearly, I should just say yes, sir, and march to the next hill. But I didn't. I was fighting and arguing, saying, no, we're here on time. And in a combat scenario, I should have been able to step back from the situation and say, what should I do next? And in my case, my failing or my learning point is that I didn't have that ability to step back and say, this is a test. I should take this course of action. And I don't regret it. Like I say, I think I came out of that course with a big F and then went on to have a fantastic career in non-special forces. And it's now led me to what I think is quite a successful business. So for me, we talked about strategic withdrawals or retreats. It's all about learning. And I'd love to think that I learned on that course and I learned from being with Ben on Exercise Timor. And hopefully that's now that part of that learning has created the person I am today.
Mate, I've got to say, we're an hour into this podcast and you can't let go of that retreat comment, can you? You just can't. And maybe that's a good thing about leadership, is you don't let go of those flagpoles, those signposts that people leave for you. I appreciate that. And again, the fascination for me in something like this is that when I've talked to the people I've talked to and they've given up of their time, like you guys have, and the other 90 or so that really good hearted people that talk to me about their leadership journey, most of them, except for the handful that have been doing the special series, have not had a life in the military context. And I think when I'm thinking leadership now and talking about it to people, this adds another toolbox to me to think, well, there are situations and times where things get to crisis point. And I think a lot more in the civilian world, we're seeing crisis coming up time and again. And if COVID-19 is not that, I don't know what would be, that tests whether or not you can put away all the minutiae and the bullshit of what's happening around you and pick the things that are going to make you and your business survive into the future. And from what I've heard from you today, and particularly Ben on multiple occasions and offline and so on, that you can't bring your people and make them a priority, you're not going to have a business to go back to. Does that ring true for both of you, gentlemen? I might start with you, Drew.
Oh, absolutely. Like I say, my father was right 13 years ago. It's all about the people. If you have an organization with good people, and as a leader, you bring those people with you, because we all hear the stories that you can't be a leader if there's no followers. If you have to take those good people with you, and you will largely be successful, or you have a greater opportunity for success. If you start with success, things like profit, and forget about the people, I just now, in hindsight, to my father's wisdom, I can't see how you can have success if you haven't invested in your, as you say, resource, but in this case, key people.
I don't know. I meant people. I hate the word resource. When you say I have, you know, you have a human resources area, why don't you just call it your people management area, or the people that deal with people? Because looking at people as a resource then to my mind converts them into a number on a bit of paper, and that's not a way to work. And I one last question before I hand over back to Ben for any follow-ups here. One thing that I'd ask you, because of the success in your business, do you think you have to be more aware of your people as your business grows, that the expansion of your business means you're less worried about the operational stuff and more about your people, the people dimension of your work? Does it get more intense as you get bigger?
When I started, it was just thinking about me and my immediate family. I now have, we've got 17 staff as the count at the moment. I think about 17 families. I think about 16 other people, 16 other families. I know most of their partners. And that's a significant part of when you start to grow. Also, right now, we're just sitting down. We've implemented an advisory board, or we're starting the process of implementing an advisory board. And part of that is our strategic goal to double our growth, slightly more than double our growth over the next 5 years. And a key part of that is now putting in the foundations of the organization. And a key part of that is the people and culture, because we recognize that we might have the best systems, we might have the customer relationship and the human resource systems, enterprise resource planning systems and the like, But if we don't invest in the people to either use those systems or understand why they need to use those systems, or as we grow, they are a key part. They're our number one business development, repeat business growth, our own staff talking about our company and how much they love being in the company, and staff retention. There's no point trying to grow if I've got staff who want to leave. So I think it's significant. It's part of our growth strategy at the moment is to focus on our people. And as what I said earlier in the podcast, Eric, is if we've got the right people and the right values and the right purpose, I think customers will see that in us. And we might tread on those toes. We might protect our values with companies we don't want to work with. But I'd like to think that most of our companies will see that, customers will see that as a strength, and our people are a key part of that.
Appreciate that, mate. Thank you.
Drew, we have one standard question for every one of our podcast guests. And I'm going to steal this one, Eric, if that's okay with you. Leaders, are they born or made? What's the Drew Horsell view on that one?
Oh, I think made. Oh, they're mostly made. I don't think any person is naturally born with all the tools needed to lead. There's certainly some inborn, there's some characteristics that you're potentially born with, predispose people to, you know, to be effective leaders. But I think even those are subject to influence. We talked about extroversion. I don't know if people are born extroverts. I think when you're raised, your family and your immediate surrounding gives you that confidence, those interpersonal skills to be an extrovert. Your assertiveness, because you have the confidence to make decisions or communicate decisions and not be punished when you're wrong, and you learn from them so you can be assertive. And I think the other one is probably intelligence. I hear people talk about that people are naturally born with intelligence. And I think that's okay for an IQ. Yes, you go to school. Yes, you learn things. But an effective leader also has EQ or emotional intelligence. And I think that's the bit that you're not necessarily born with. That's certainly an influence of the culture that surrounds you. But yeah, I'd love to think, I won't put a percentage on it, but I would say that they're mostly made. Can I ask what you think, Ben? You and I have trodden the same paths.
Look, it's interesting with all our guests, Drew. I definitely, when I was a podcast guest with Eric on his standard podcast, Talking Leadership, I said made, but I absolutely agree with your final comment about EQ. I think that's something that cannot be, and that only emphasizes the made comment, but it simply cannot be born. It has to be developed. And we see many a leader that is literally promoted on the value of their IQ. And then what happens is their EQ all of a sudden becomes a thing they need to lean on, and it's just simply not there. And they fail. And then they have to retreat, Eric. No, just No. So, yeah, I think when we go back to our conversation with David Neal, he was very much around the phrase both. I think you're right, Drew. There are some natural leadership qualities that come out. And I draw the analogy of someone who happens to be the son of an AFL footballer who just happens to be good as well. But I think if I was to put a percentage on it, I think it would be at least 70% made or more.
Thanks for that, Ben. And it's easy to find another co-host, Gabe, given that last comment you made, sir. I think being able to understand the environment in which you work and having that emotional intelligence, there's a light and dark side to that. I think the people that are genuine about wanting to grow and help develop others is, for me, the product of being a leader, and that's of being of service to others, which is fundamentally what I believe now in my heart of hearts. But there's also the born leader that uses that to manipulate outcomes to make sure that they get what they want. And we've all met those people before, and they exist in the corporate world. I'm sure they exist in the military world. And the thing that gives me some thought on this, and also a bit of conflict in my own mind, is that that's my subjective judgment about what they're doing. And, you know, sometimes in some corporate worlds, and I think the bottom line is making that profit and getting those numbers in, and it's about meeting those targets, sometimes EQ and people's feelings goes out the door and it's about getting the task done. I've seen those industries. I've worked in construction myself. Builder doesn't give a flying hoo-ha about your feelings. They just want a job done. And the reality of work sometimes doesn't quite mesh with the theory. Now, that having been said, not being a good human being is not a good thing for your own mental health anyway. And given that we spend so much bloody time in the world of work, I'd rather it be a productive, fun space where you can have a joke and laugh at yourself, much like we've done at my expense in this podcast. It makes things fun. If you can't realize that and not take yourself too seriously, it makes for a worse time. I learned that coming up in my own career. I've seen it in other people's careers. And I personally, and this may be for another podcast, but definitely want to put this on the record now, I think too much time is spent on this thing around a person's emotional intelligence. That rings true for me to a point. But then there's a point, you just got to get some shit done. You've got to rely on people's professionalism and feel it. Facts don't care about your feelings. And this is something I think people need to learn in the world of leadership, that you've got some tasks to get done. And if people feel a certain way about it, I don't give a flying, I don't care, get it done. I'm not pressuring you. I rely on your professionalism. The emotion bit to me is a bit overplayed. And I think it's done in the world of LinkedIn a lot about you got to respect the emotions and let's have an emotion part. I don't subscribe to that stuff. If you're genuine about what you do and people believe that you're there for the right reasons, they will back you. And I think maybe it's about genuineness. And if this sounds a bit harsh, I've had 10 years working in the commercial seafood industry in Queensland, and I've met people that have done it tough their whole lives, fourth, fifth, sixth generation commercial fishing people. These people know what a hard time is and about what being genuine is. And if I've got anything to thank them for, amongst multiple things about being a better person, is that my bullshit radar is highly attuned after 10 years of working in this industry. And if I've got anything to take to my next roles or talking to people or even doing these podcasts, if I've got the sniffer that there's some BS happening, I will call it out. And I don't have a problem doing that. But it took me 25 years of being in the world of work to develop a thicker skin and be able to take a few knocks and also ask some uncomfortable questions. And I learned that from having these discussions as well, that not that you'd ever say it on a podcast, but I'm sure there's been times where you've just the mind's blown and you've dumped on something that's been of importance to you, and necessarily the feelings of the people involved don't come into it. Because at the end of the day, if I had 17, 16 families relying on me to progress, the feelings party is important, but it's not all of it. And if we're here to do a professional job, just get in and do the job. So sorry to throw that one in there, but I think EQ is sometimes done to death. And I'm not necessarily on that same bandwagon. It's important, but there's other important capabilities and thinking as well. Drew, your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I certainly would say never dismiss the EQ, the importance of it. Anyone who's ever had a relationship with me will know that I can be just this absolute lack of empathy, cold, hard, decisive decision maker. You know, I've been through divorce, I've been through breakups, I've been through, issues with my own children and the like. And I'm not shedding tears and crying and pleading. I'm just like, you're out. And that's very tough for people to see, particularly when I'll turn on Finding Nemo and I'm in tears. And I really struggle, but that's a part of the military in me that I don't like anymore, that I can be this cool hand Luke, but I really struggle to show emotion. But like I say, you know, those TAC ads that come on, or, you know, the road toll things that come on, or you read about some horrific news about children online, and it brings me to tears every time. But when it comes to a tough decision, I'm cool hand Luke, you're out, or you're fired, I think would be the Trump-esque term. But I think EQ is important, because even though I can make a tough call, I also need to consider the ramification of my call. And a good leader would always know and appreciate the ramifications before they make a decision. You may disregard them, such as somebody's how they feel afterwards, but I think you certainly need to consider it.
Yeah, agreed. Ben?
Yeah, look, I think reflecting on some of your comments, I probably become a tad self-reflective in certain environments. I think that when I've seen, and I do a little bit of leadership coaching as part of my business now, and you know, lawyers can be, you know, if you look at that personality profiling exercise called DISC, they can be very dominant people and also very conscientious. And the dominant side of people want to get shit done. And that can lead them to be very demanding of people and those sort of things. But I think that some of the examples you use there, Eric, I would step back and question and say, well, that person or people or group of employees or whatever, if you're needing to be that just get shit done and I don't care about your situation, I might ask the question, well, as a group, how are they not motivated? Why are they not motivated to cause me to have that outcome?
So Ben, before you go on, what I meant was that you have EQ in your mind, but to me, it's not my primary driver. So still show respect, still value their input, but it's not the only thing that drives my leadership. And what I was trying to get at before, and I maybe I didn't articulate it well, is that what I'm seeing now is more this mass focus on it being a key thing about your leadership. And I don't think it is. I think it's a meld of all the things we've been talking about. So your people, how you plan in your business, how you're bringing in external stakeholders. I think all of that meshes in together to get a balance. And that's I think, if anything, that's the art of leadership. And we've talked about this before, Ben. I think you said to me, find that balance. And I get that. So I wasn't trying to sell no EQ, no emotional connection, but it can't be the primary thing that drives you in your business. For me, at least, it can't be the primary driver of your capability as a leader. That's all I meant.
I didn't take it like that, Eric. What I was saying is, in just that piece of reflection, I think I used a phrase once, and I'm not sure what your thoughts are on this phrase, Drew, is that a leader need not give orders unless the building is on fire or unless you're under fire. And I think I added that last bit on myself, but I like to think that, particularly in my post-military career, and even during my military career, I rarely gave an order with the phrase, this is a direct order on the end of it. I was more, dare I say, collaborative and more collaborative. And I like to sort of motivate people to come to me with ideas and then, throw them into the pot, stir it up and see what the recipe ends up as. So my point in relation to your piece before was more, probably my own EQ, stepping back saying, why am I in this situation? Or as Drew said, right back at the start, having that strategic understanding, but why they're doing this and what their role is in it. So, and yeah, sometimes you just got to say, guys, we just got to pull our shit together and get this done. We got an hour to get this tender submitted. Everyone's got to get on the tools and get it done. I don't know about you, Drew, but I still use the two thirds, one third rule when I need to give delegation. If I have a week to get something done, I ask for it to come back to me in 3 days. So I've got 2 days to do my piece. Do you still apply that theory?
Yes and no. I probably actually add a little bit more fat into the schedule because I work largely with government departments. So the two thirds, one third.
1 year.
we usually add a little bit more time in because I talked about the micromanagement and again, this comes back to governance. When you're dealing with non-public monies and you're a government organisation, you generally are less risk, you're more risk adverse in making decisions. So you want to, take that extra time to actually make sure that it's correct, because the consequence of poor governance is you are spending our money. We pay tax. Your listeners all pay tax, or most of them. And I think, therefore, that it's probably a bit of a shift between the one-third, two-third rule, but you certainly have to consider that into your time frame, that you shouldn't take time away from your subordinates' own planning just because you've spent too much time overthinking it.
And just for the listeners, Eric, in our training, we were always suggested that whatever time frame that we had to deliver a particular outcome, if we were to delegate certain aspects of it, you would always give the, as Drew said, the subordinates at least two thirds of the time to do their own delivery and give you one third at the end to execute it. So that's where the one third, two third rule comes from a delegation perspective.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's great. Drew, thank you for your time today, mate. This has been an interesting podcast. I was hoping that each one of these would throw out some unique discussions, and it has, and it's got me thinking about a couple of things about balance when you're talking about leadership and the balance in your head and what does that look like. And you've painted a very detailed picture of what that looks like for you. I appreciate your candor, particularly around how you make decisions, and that you can take the boy out of the military, but you can't take the military out of the boy. And that seemed to come through pretty strongly with you, as it has with all of our guests, is that I don't think you can ever leave the way that they've trained you behind. And maybe that's one of the secrets to how the military train their leaders that we haven't quite picked up in the civilian sector just yet, is that there's some combination of what they do to train you guys, as well as the ongoing development, that is different to the civilian space. And this is conversations that I want to have in the future. And I think on this topic, and I've already written this down in my office, which I'm not in at the moment, that I'd like to do some panels around thinking about that kind of stuff into the future, that the training of our leaders in the civilian world, is it as good as it could be? And if it's not, why not? Because one of the questions I've been asking people in the know is, if I ask you the question, do you think you have fit for future leaders in your industry? The answer is never an immediate yes. There's always some hesitation or some thinking. And to me, if the leadership cadre across our industries were as good as they could be, those yeses would come thick and fast, and sometimes they're not coming in that way. So what is that saying about how we train our leaders, particularly how we train the next generation of young people take on leadership roles? And I'm not advocating for a total military domination of how we train people, but there's something in how you guys get trained that could be of benefit in the corporate world. And I know that happens at the moment. It's been happening for years, but it's not the norm. And so for me, the ongoing benefit of these discussions is that it brings up other issues that people may not want to talk about. And I'm happy to be that bloke that asks the difficult question, because if people aren't asking that question, then discussions don't get to be had about this stuff. And I think it's worth having. So for those listening and have had dealings with Drew or dealings with Ben or me, this is why these discussions are here. And I'll offer my guest firstly any final comments before we wrap up, Drew?
Oh, well, look, Eric and Ben, thank you both very much for the opportunity to talk today. It's actually been fun. And Eric, the R word that you mentioned before, the thing that I wanted to say is that when I was in the military, I absolutely probably would have gone to task on you and explained to you the difference. But since becoming a civilian leader, I'd like to think that I now sit in your shoes as well. And there's many things that occur in the military that I don't understand. I'm fortunate I consult back into defense, and I'm always talking about my old days, or I'm popping up my acronyms that are no longer used, because I think I now recognize that, okay, whilst you think you've been chastised, you haven't. I actually acknowledge and say that civilians don't understand the military, but they don't need to. You don't need to know the difference between the two, and we shouldn't expect you to know the difference between the two. So there's no right or wrong. And I think when the military leave and become a civilian leader, they need to acknowledge that as well, that the people around them don't understand military. So don't hold them to task over a bit. Don't punish them about it. And I'd like to think that we've been having a bit of a joke at you, Eric, because you're of the spirit where you can take it. But I think when you move from a military to a civil environment, you must realise that it's a different environment, and that not everyone knows how you used to do your job, and you probably need to change a little bit when you get out. But that being said, I think there's many, many similarities between military and civilian leadership. There's a few key differences, but I think at the end of the day, we have a lot to learn from each other, if that makes sense.
I appreciate it, mate. And I'll be thinking about these barbs and these shots you guys have taken at me for many days yet. I'll be talking to that Ben Devison bloke about maybe getting another co-host.
That's it.
After today. But no, jokes aside, yeah, no, all good. And I do appreciate that. One thing to take out of this for me is that when you're trying to understand another person's perspective, what appears to you to be one way can be something else. And that, I think from a civilian point of view, we don't know enough about your world, so we make assumptions. And like most people, when they think, whether you're applying strategic thinking cognitions around that or foresight or whatever it is to try and explain the world around you, when you don't have information, you tend to fill in the blanks with stuff that you think you know. And if anything, I'd want to encourage more of these debates amongst people, because it makes for better leadership. And if you can't have it with a sense of good humor, then there's no point in having this, because you could write up these conversations, it's not the same. And before I go, and to make it very clear, the reason for doing these podcasts is I don't always want to read about what better leadership practice is. I want to hear it from the people that have lived it. I think we need to learn everything we can. And if in the toolkit you can draw something from another walk of life, it's interesting. And I'm hoping to be able to get to cultures like the sporting world, like the emergency services, police, AMBOs. These people work in high pressure environments as well. And I would suggest that if you're talking about the world of quick decision making and very much all these variables coming in, and you've got to make a call, I think those two worlds with your worlds intersect quite interestingly. And so when I've got the time next year to be able to do a bit of a panel on this, I want to get people from those different places in that room to see what are the sames and what are the differences. And it'll be with co-host Drew Horsell instead of maybe co-host Ben Devison, but you never know. You never know in this big bad world. Ben, any final thoughts from you, good sir?
I have one very resonating thought from our guests today, Eric, and that is the comment that Drew made right back at the start about his people first focus. And there are so many businesses that write those two words on a piece of paper and stick it on a wall. And I've actually seen and challenged people on that very decision that Drew makes what appears to be on a regular basis, and that is he will always put his people ahead of a contract. And that, my friend, is an extremely gutsy call, but it is the right one. And it equally will generate, from a leader's perspective, an enormous amount of loyalty from your people. If you stand by your values and actually say, here, I've made this decision because it's the right thing for our business and our people. That, for me, is the key takeaway from today. So, Drew, well done on that stance, and that will only stand you in good stead. But that's my key resonating thought from today's discussion.
No worries, gentlemen. So for those listening, we've been speaking to Drew Horsell, who is the owner and director of Horsell. Thank you for your time, Drew. And I'd like to thank, as always, Ben Deverson, my co-host in crime here on this podcast. And Ben is the director, leader, owner of Lorganize. So thank you both for your time today.
Thanks, Eric.
For those thanks, Eric and Ben.
Thanks, Drew. Good man.
No worries, Drew. Thank you, guys. And for those listening, this has been Talking Leadership. As always, I'll catch you all on the next podcast.